you have until our provisions arrive, provisions which will help us break into your elegant home. If you don't deliver him by the aforementioned time, we'll release the beast on him and on you. We don't want to kill our own. Please just let us purge.
Why are you doing this to us?
Because you are home.
The second you get within 2 feet of me, I'm gonna snap your neck and crack your spine.
And I'll shoot you dead.
And his spine will be cracked.
And you'll be dead.
And his spine will be cracked.
He's bluffing. How do you know that?
Huh? He's FBI. He knows this stuff.
Yeah, Paul. I know that stuff.
Please just let us go. Look, you have everything ahead of you. You're still so young. Nothing's really happened yet. We could just say George's leg broke on the boat. Everyone will believe us, I promise you.
Please don't do this. Just... Why are you degrading yourself? It's as painful for me as it is for you.
You don't know anybody by the name of Iris?
I don't know nobody named Iris.
No? You got a gun?
Yeah.
Suck on this.
I am death. Vengeance is mine.
Winter is coming.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Good. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Dave here.
Dave, how's it going?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be back, in fact.
Excellent, excellent. Welcome back after a couple of weeks off. And we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Excellent. And Eric won't be able to join us tonight, but we do have a special guest host from Virginia.
Hi, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how's it going?
It's going well. Glad to be
here. Excellent. Very good. Very good. For folks who don't know Barrett, he has been on a couple of our episodes recently as a guest host here and there. He's out of Virginia, as mentioned, and me and him work together for our same employer, basically. So thanks for joining us tonight, Barrett. Tonight, before we get into anything, who we are for new listeners, we are Dark Discussions Podcast, www.darkdiscussions.com. And, what we do is critique and review, not just critique and not just review, genre films. So that would be horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, cult films, midnight movies, and things of that nature. Basically, we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We do have an email as well, darkdiscussions@aol.com. So if you want to email us, please do, and you can give us anything you want, whether it's opinions, reviews, discussions on books or movies or video games or anime that you've seen that may interest our listeners, and we will read those emails on the podcast. Also, we have a Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where you can discuss various topics, including what you've seen, favorite horror actors, actresses, you know, anything like that. You can start your own discussion, or you can join the discussions that are already there. We do have the website, as I mentioned. What can people find there?
All right. So, if you want to take a moment to visit us, if you want to listen to more episodes down the road, visit us at darkdiscussions.com. All the episodes that we have completed, most of them, in fact, are up right now to listen to for free. If you look on the right-hand side of the site as well, you'll find blogs and other sites that might be of interest to you. So if you want to check it out at any point while listening to this episode or the next, please do. Any more traffic of listeners and followers is a great help to us.
Yep, absolutely. And Mike, we do have a Patreon. What's that all about?
Patreon is a website that helps support independent projects like the Dark Discussions podcast. Producing the podcast does cost some money, especially the hosting fees to provide these 430-odd episodes that we provide every day for everybody to download for free from the internet. So if you'd like to help us maintain that server, maintain our access, and all the other things, the technical upgrades Phil has to do every now and then please consider giving a donation to Patreon. If you subscribe, for every $5 that you give us a month, you get an entry into our quarterly drawing, and another where you can pick a film for us to cover. So for every $5, it's one entry. So if you donate $15, that's three entries. You can use three of the same film or three different films. And then when we have our drawing, in fact, we have one coming up in a couple of weeks, right?
Actually, we're doing it tonight.
Oh, we have a drawing tonight. Woohoo!
Right.
Random number generator time.
Woohoo!
That's right.
So you'll so you'll get a firsthand account of how exactly this works. And we pick our next film to do. We do have our last film we still have to do because it is not readily available to stream yet. But as soon as it is readily available, we will make sure that we cover that. But we have done films. I'm trying to remember. We've done The Howling. We did what was the – It's Alive. What else have been films that were
The Orphan.
Dead Man, The Orphan. Yeah, so there's a lot of films.
What's the one with Johnny Depp? The other one with Johnny
Dead
Depp,
Man.
Not Dead. No, the other one. The one that Roman Polanski directed.
Oh,
Ninth Gate.
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah.
So it could be new, it could be old, it could be whatever you want.
Right. Exactly. Maybe we'll be able to do another Johnny Depp film. We need more Johnny Depp. I've been watching the Pirates of the Caribbean films with the kiddos, and they really like them. Because we saw someone dressed as Jack Sparrow at a convention late last year, and so they've always liked that character, and now they get to see him on the film. So that's a film right there that people could put in, one of the Pirates of Caribbean films. All right, so anybody, so Mike, you have that random generator up, or whatever it's called, generator?
Yes, I have the random number generator up and ready.
Okay.
Tell me what number to pick up to.
Okay, 417.
Oh, I was so close. I typed in 1 and 420. Okay,
ooh,
417.
Close.
All right, and generate. Nope, I missed. Generate. Nope, didn't work. There it goes. All right, and the number between 1 and 417 is 62.
Mothman Prophecies.
Huh, interesting.
Oh, like that.
Never watched it.
That's cool.
I haven't seen that in a while.
Yeah, it's pretty
nice
solid.
And creepy.
Solid.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. They actually have a Mothman Museum right on the river between West Virginia and Kentucky. And that was a side trip that myself and Anthony Thurber were possibly going to stop at if we went down to Skazakia this summer. But with the coronavirus, I don't know if there will be a Skazakia. But yeah, Barrett, I think it's only about 6 hours from Richmond or 5 hours from Richmond. So it's it could be something to check out. I don't know how big it is, but maybe I'll put up the link on the Facebook group, especially now that that's a film that's an option for us to do. And that one we can probably do almost immediately because that's available everywhere to watch. So nice. All right. Good. And you haven't seen it, Mike. So that's always good. Abe, have you seen that one? Mothman Prophecies?
I seen it a long time ago. It was. So it'd be interesting to revisit it.
Yeah, it's
oh my gosh.
Cast.
Yeah. I love that movie. I really
love that movie. I'm not a Richard Gere fan, but I really liked him in that.
Also, everybody drink, Mike, drink. Laura Linney of Ozark also stars in it. She's the co-star.
Yep.
That's right. So, yeah, that's a good one. I'll have to let Eric know, and we'll get that on the agenda to do sooner than later. All right, so let's see what we're going to do. Oh, and so, yeah, folks, definitely join Patreon. We could use the help, and definitely there's a good chance that we could do a film for you to the reason we do it is obviously is what Mike said. It's not free what we're doing. We're basically running this in the red. But if you do help the podcast, we can at least do something back for you besides weekly episodes. Maybe actually do a topic that you have chosen. And I'm not sure who chose the Mothman prophecies, because this is one of the earlier numbers where I didn't put the names of the people next to it. But so be it.
I hope they're still listening. If so, please send us your name.
Indeed.
If you're not listening, send us your name anyway.
Indeed. Indeed. All right. Mike, what's going on with this episode? This is kind of a special episode for unfortunate reason, I should say.
Yeah, well, because all the theaters are shut down, we are kind of hitting stuff that's just streaming. Not that we don't do a lot of streaming stuff, but
I got it. Chris Jenner. This was Chris Jenner's.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I'm not sure if he's still listening to our podcast, but yep. Anyway, continue. Mike, sorry about that.
Lost my train of thought. Oh, right. So because the theaters are shut down, we're kind of hitting a lot of streaming stuff. And then, unfortunately, last week we lost Stuart Gordon, who is a rather significant director in the recent horror genre, directing a lot of films. Most notably is, of course, Reanimator, which is considered a classic by most fans. But we decided we'd delve into one of his catalog titles and do something in tribute to him this week, since, one, he was a good guy, he was good to the horror community, and he kind of deserves a little recognition, and also because, well, why not? We have nothing else to do, and we decided not to do Reanimator because we figure everyone else is probably going to be doing that. And so tonight's episode is his early 2000s, I believe, H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, Dagon.
We are in a boat off the coast of España.
Honey, our stock could be going underwater and we wouldn't even know it.
What are you doing?
I'm just going on vacation.
I'd say we've got a storm coming up.
Break us down! Did it!
We're gonna have to take the raft into that town for help.
Whoa! We need help!
What kind of church is this?
What the hell's going on here?
I'm supposed to meet someone here. A woman? Senorita? You want to tell me what's wrong with everybody in this town?
I tell you a secret. No one leaves. People come, but no one leaves.
Why are you trying to kill us? What are we doing here?
I am here. I've been waiting for you.
Barbara?
Lady Flavor.
And the child will be immortal.
If it happens to me, you've got to promise you'll kill me.
Come on, motherfucker.
Forget your world and your friends. There will be no time. No today, no yesterday. Only the forever. And forever. And forever without end.
I don't have a choice, do I?
That's right. Dagon is a 2001 film, again, directed by Stuart Gordon, written by a guy named Dennis Paoli. Dennis Paoli co-wrote most of Gordon's films, Reanimator, From Beyond, and his shows on Masters of Horror, among other things. The film was produced by a number of folks, including Brian Yuzna, who's also worked with Stuart Gordon for almost all his films. The film was a Lionsgate film in the U.S., but it's actually a Spanish film. It was produced and made by a number of folks from Spain. It was actually filmed in Galicia, which is the province directly north of the nation of Portugal. And a lot of the Spanish in the movie will not be familiar to most Spanish people because it actually wasn't Spanish that was being spoken. It was Galician, which is very different than Spanish. If folks were listening, it sounds more Italian or Portuguese than Spanish. When I put the subtitles on, a lot of the words were all, they were all Galician words. It was kind of funny. Even the names for the characters, Uxia, for example, with the letter X, Spain generally doesn't use us, or Spanish doesn't usually use the X, except, in like Mexico with the Indian names and whatnot. But, Galicia, X is a common letter in their alphabet. So most of the folks are unknowns, at least for me. There was one actress that is pretty big in Spain, and that was Macarena Gomez, who plays, I guess, the secondary lead woman, but kind of the lead, depending on what you think, and we'll talk about it. And then Francisco Rebel plays a drunk in this film, and he was a pretty huge actor in Spain. This was actually his last role. He died about I think a couple of months after it was filmed, from basically emphysema from smoking too much at the age of 72. So that's the only two people of note, but those people would be probably known just over in Europe. All right, so I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So let's start with you, Chrissy, since you actually chose this film, because we were thinking a few films. We were thinking of maybe From Beyond or Stuck, but you mentioned this one, and everybody pretty much jumped on board.
Yeah, I had a very interesting experience with this film. I saw it when it came out in the theaters in 2001. I had been volunteering for the first time at the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. So I was finally living my dream of working with fish. And believe it or not, when I saw this film, I was not a Lovecraft fan. I actually had probably never even really heard of Lovecraft because I was much more trained in literary short stories and stuff, and my parents were very careful to keep me away from horror. So simply because I was easily frightened, believe me, they did the right thing. So I went to see this, and I remember being extremely disappointed because I think I was expecting something else. So I was very excited to revisit this film. And in fact, when we said we were going to do it, I went out right away and got the big Vestron Video Blu-ray with all the special features, because now, of course, I do have a familiarity with Lovecraft, and I really enjoy reading Lovecraft, and I am familiar with the stories on which this movie is based, because this movie is actually based on two of his short stories, and they kind of put them together, and the reason they picked Dagon was because the producer felt that it was a much better title for a horror film than Shadow over Innsmouth.
Right. Well, Chrissy, yeah. Chrissy, they had to change it anyway, because they weren't using it. They moved it to Spain or Galicia rather than New England, right? And there wouldn't be a town named.
Yeah, but that didn't have anything to do with it. They would have called it Shadow over Imbolca, to the interview that I read anyway.
Gotcha.
They didn't. They wanted to use Dagon instead, and they combined the two stories. And actually, apparently, this script had been floating around. I guess the writer had written it in the 80s. It was originally supposed to be the follow-up to Reanimator, and it never got made. And apparently the script had been rewritten several times, and it went through all these different iterations. However, this script is the closest to the original one that the guy wrote eventually. They ended up going back to the original. And there was another reason why they shot in Spain, too, that the whole thing, the whole reason it got moved to Spain, they had actually scouted in the Northeast and chosen all of these locations, and they knew what they were going to do and where they were going to film it. And then I totally forget what the reason was, but they ended up going in Spain and moving it over. So that's why the initial title was going to be Shadow over Innsmouth, because they really were going to film in Maine. Anyway, so I rewatched this week and was absolutely delighted with it, especially since I had read both of the stories on which it's based. I love the sound design in this is incredible. The atmosphere is mind-blowing. The sets are phenomenal. And just the attention to detail in terms of being very Lovecraftian and sticking with a lot of the original material, it is really faithful. I think the only other real super faithful one that I've seen is Color Out of Space. And of course, you do have to manipulate these things to get them to be for modern day and stuff like that. So when I say faithful, I mean basically the plot sort of stays the same, or the actual spirit of it stays the same. It doesn't go, off the rails completely. So I really enjoyed this film. I thought the acting was phenomenal. The costumes were fantastic. I liked some of the odd things that they added to it. Of course, this movie is one of the primary themes in this movie is the same, is one of the primary themes also in Lovecraft's work itself, which is identity. And can you really defy your genes, what you are born with, your DNA? Because Lovecraft was very disturbed by the fact that, his mom was kind of nuts. His father had gotten syphilis and gone nuts. And I think he was always haunted by that. If you read some scholarly papers on his life, there are some scholars that do talk about that, that he was very, frightened by that. And as a writer, of course, Phil, that you will continue to work with the same themes over and over and over until you resolve whatever it is that's bugging you. The other interesting thing I wanted to note, I think they did a wonderful job with doing things like not translating what the people were saying, because it puts us in the character's shoes and makes us really uncomfortable. It drove me nuts that I couldn't understand what they were saying, but I kind of liked that. And certainly, like I said, I saw this originally. I barely remembered any of it. All I remembered was feeling disappointed and like a couple of images. That was it. So anyway, that's my experience with the movie.
All right. Very good. I think you were the only one that has actually seen this film before tonight's episode, prior to this week. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So it is interesting to hear your perspective, and let's see what everybody else has to say. So let's go with our guest tonight, Barrett.
You had talked about this movie just a couple days ago. I kept seeing it around, on the different streaming services, and I've wanted to watch it. I try to watch as much Lovecraft-based stuff as possible. So I was pretty excited to watch it, and I was very pleasantly surprised. I thought it was way better than I expected, and I was very happy to see the movie, and I'm happy to talk about it now.
All right, very good. Mike?
I've known about it. I never watched it. For some reason, I kept confusing this with, I don't know why, the Dean Stockwell early 70s film, The Dunwich Horror, which I did try to watch. I couldn't get into a number of years ago, and I maybe because it's Lovecraft and begins with a D. Anyhow, but I did kind of want to revisit it. I know it came recommended by independent filmmaker Mike Lombardo, who I've mentioned before, who directed I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday. And so that kind of got me curious to check it out again, although he has recommended some truly awful films just out of nostalgia reasons. But I did want to take a look at it, and I have like everything else that I've seen from Stuart Gordon. You know, and Reanimator and From Beyond mean a lot to me. Stuck, I thought, was a good film. His two segments on Masters of Horror, really good. And I recently watched Dolls. I like that a lot. So I really enjoyed his output. I said, well, let me give that give this a try. The film is very dated in that it is set in 2001, and some of the special effects really do not hold up. Sometimes one of the worst things to hold up are cutting edge special effects. Those age worse than anything else. But if you put that aside and put some scripting issues and acting issues aside, it does work. I was surprised too. I thought it worked fairly well. I really thought a lot of the makeup they did, especially the subtle makeup, was well done. I agree with Chrissy in terms of the sets, in terms of using the location. And ironically, or weirdly, you know, we were just talking about this yesterday with Black Summer, where there's a character in that film that speaks Korean, and we don't know what she's saying for the entire film because they never translate what she says. But I think that adds something to that show. And I think here, since we're following the perspective of the lead actor, and he does, or the lead character, and the lead character doesn't speak the native language, he doesn't know what's being said, so we're also left in the dark. And I think that's very appropriate. I kind of like the fact that we have to try to puzzle out what they said, and so it worked. That worked for me, and it does end as all Lovecraft films really ought to end. I kind of like this. I'm surprised. I still wouldn't put it above some of his earlier works. But no, I did enjoy it.
All right. Very good. I'll go next. I don't know why I'd never bothered wanting to see it. I was actually surprised to find out it was a 2001 film. I just assumed it was a 1980s film. For some reason, I thought the same actors and actresses from his earlier films were in this one, but they weren't at all. I have to say that I actually really liked the film. It was a pleasant surprise. It actually reminded me more with 1970s and 80s Italian and continental horror films than a regular Stuart Gordon film, which is kind of interesting. Chrissy's absolutely right. The sound is fantastic here. Basically, surround sound I had on my TV system, and it was unbelievable. So the sound is really good. I have to say that some of the special effects, as Mike said, were kind of poor, specifically the CGI, but all the practical effects were awesome. And I would say it's about 80 to 85% practical effects. And then the 15% is the quote unquote cutting edge CGI kind of effects that Mike was mentioning that don't hold up. But generally, all the practical effects do. The story actually is very, very close, as Chrissy said, to the short stories Dargon and Shadow of an Innsmouth. So that actually is true, that it's one of Lovecraft films that actually don't move away from his story and keep faithful to it. And also for folks who just want midnight movie, B movie madness, there's plenty of body horror, nudity, gore, monsters. The Harbinger you know, so it's got all that stuff. So for folks who just like that type of movie too, it has it all as well. So I would give it a big thumbs up, and it is an underappreciated cult classic, I would say, that folks should check out if they haven't seen it yet. Abe.
So I think the only film Gordon's I've seen was Dolls. I never saw From Beyond, and this is my first time watching Dagon. I watched it recently, just a couple like an hour or so ago, just to keep it fresh, because it was my first viewing of it. And it's just an interesting film. I never read the original stories they were based on. I could see there are certain very faithful, a lot of heart put into capturing the feel of the Lovecraftian stories from imagery, like character, like the creature designs and stuff like that. And I loved. I thought some of the soundtrack was really good. The sound design was really solid for the most part, though. I think the choices of using dolphin and seal sounds was kind of a little silly. Just kind of took me out of it a little bit. And as well as the computer generated effects, but the practical effects were really cool. I really loved the eerie feel of the whole village. This kind of very impressive, very decrepit place. Performances were up and down. We had some really good ones and some that are very cheesy. It had one of the most shocking death scenes I've seen. It's not a recent film, but if it had been like a this year kind of film, it would have been really up there because it was a pretty brutal one. And it was an entertaining watch overall. I think I had more fun watching The Mouth of Madness, but this is still a solid film that I think, you know, some people should check out, especially if they love Lovecraftian stuff. It's gonna be interesting to talk about. I'm glad I made it for this episode.
All right, very good. Abe, you're absolutely right. If this was a brand new film, one of the deaths in this movie would easily make the kill of the year for sure. Because it is pretty drastic. Where can you see this film? You can pretty much see it anywhere for rental. So it's available rental anywhere, and you can actually purchase it VOD as well for just a couple bucks more than the rental fee. I actually saw it free on Tubi. I had like three commercial breaks, but uncut otherwise. So it's there for free. There's a fairly new disc that just came out, I think, last year or a year and a half ago. On Dagon by Vestron Video, which is basically Lionsgate. So it's a remastered disc of it, and it has 2 hours of extras, including it's 4 hours of extras because it – nope, 6 hours of extras. How about that? So it has two commentaries.
We have eight.
They have two commentaries in it with the director and screenwriter, and then the director – and one of the stars. They have 2 hours worth of documentary or videos, interviews, and all that stuff. So it's a packed disc. And if people are familiar with the Vestron releases, such as Chopping Mall and various other ones that have come out in the past 6 years or so, this one seems to be full top notch, just like those.
If for some reason my wife is listening, because we watched this together today, if my wife happens to be listening, I just want to point out that Dagon did get a collector's edition special release with 2 commentary tracks, 6 hours worth of extras, and there's still no sign of Looking for Mr. Goodbar coming out on disc. Just want to rub that in. Sorry.
There you go. What did Pam think of this movie, Mike?
I'm not really sure. We didn't get a chance to chat about it because we did just watch it today. I have a feeling she wasn't that into it early on. I did get an audible reaction out of her after what I'm thinking is the death scene everyone is talking about. But I was kind of, honestly, I was shaky at the beginning of the film too, because she was like, who asked to watch this film? Usually when she asks that, it's kind of a, you know, basically like, who in their right mind thought you should be watching this movie?
Well, she has a point there, because around the 18 to 20 minute mark, and that's the point where the lead actor goes to his hotel room. And at that point, that's when the movie really starts rocking. And
There's some terrible, terrible writing in the beginning of the film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
I don't need Chrissy to point that out to me.
Good. I'm glad I don't have to.
And I mean, you're already for me off to a shaky start when you have when you start a movie off with a dream sequence, movie starts out with a dream sequence. There's very clunky expository dialogue at the start, where they're forcing in all of that. I guess, Chris, you've referred to as you know, Bob. Kind of dialogue. Well, you know, where they make sure they drop in, you know, that he's rich, you know, all these other things. Like, they give you most of the background information that you need to give to know who the characters are. Not that there's a lot, because there's really only one character you worry about for the entire film.
Well, and that's the thing that's interesting about those as you know, Bob things, is because when we start talking about the theme of identity, all of that stuff had to be in there or had to be communicated. And I'm giving this a lot of thought since I watched this on Tuesday night. I don't know how else that could have been. I would have to sit down and really look at the script and figure out how they could have gotten that in a better way, but still gotten that point across. But I'll talk about that later. But there is a reason that it's there. And the reason that they did open with a dream sequence is only because, again, that is a direct, that is in day, that's the connection to the Dagon short story. Because the Dagon short story really talks about how this guy discovers this stuff. Okay. Cause I know we're still not doing spoilers yet. This stuff, and then it haunts him for the rest of his life. So I think that might have been there, but I agree with you. I think, let's put it this way. You never start a book, a short story, a film. You just don't do it, man. Don't start with a dream sequence. But in this particular case, it didn't bother me as much, because I could see why they needed that in there. I just wish they had done it a little bit differently, but that's okay. Anyway.
Sure. All right. So, Abe, do we have a wiki?
Yes, we do. Wiki. A boat in accident runs a young man and woman ashore in a decrepit Spanish fishing town, which they discover is in the grips of an ancient sea god and its monstrous half-human offspring.
All right. Yeah, that's fair. It obviously gives a lot out, but I mean, most people who probably gone into the movie knew it was a horror film anyway, and whatnot. So works for me. All right. So I guess we could talk about anything and everything. Well, actually, let's just talk about anything related to the film or Stuart Gordon that isn't spoiler before we throw up the spoiler alert.
I am going to leave that to you, gentlemen, because I know actually not very much about Stuart Gordon or his career. So you guys,
right? Well, it could also be about this film and how it's based off of the Lovecraft stories too, Chrissy. So you know you can bring that up too, which is not really a spoiler.
Don't go back, Chrissy, because I don't know much about Stuart Gordon either.
I had no idea he did Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh, yeah, that was kind of a shock. Yeah, he did. In fact, when he was approached about doing this movie or something, when they first started talking about maybe digging up that old script or maybe, when was Honey, I Shrunk the Kids? Was that the
1989, yes.
Okay.
June 23rd.
He said in an interview he was working on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and he was cutting pieces of, or no, I don't know, something about Roy Disney, and Roy Disney saw pieces of Dagon, I guess, and was like, oh my God, and like he thought he was going to lose his job, so, but I think it was, maybe he was working on a later iteration, I don't know, something about, that, damn it, I should have made the note, because it was a really interesting story, but anyway, you guys go ahead.
Well, you said it was something that had been in development for a long time. It was going to be his follow-up to Reanimator. Reanimator was, I think, 85 or 86.
Right. Yep. And the thing was, the reason that it was in development hell is they could not find anybody, apparently, according to the things that I listened to, the interviews and such, they couldn't find anyone that really was excited about it because they said, oh, it's fish people. Like, there's nothing scary about fish people. If you want to do, like, werewolves, and that's specifically what he was told. Right. If you want to do werewolves or whatever, or vampires and shit, you know, yeah, we'll totally do it. But fish people, yeah, no way. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody cares. And I thought that was kind of interesting only because, if you think about it, this really isn't a story about fish people. It is a story about religion. It is a story about choice. It is a story about identity. It's which, you know, werewolves in particular ties into that whole identity thing. Yeah, it does. There's a couple of monsters that tie into the identity thing. But anyway, I just found that really amusing that they were like, yeah, nobody gives a fuck. Nobody cares. Nobody likes fish people.
No, and I can, again, I can get that. First of all, consider when it was coming out. I know that in that whole period that he was probably trying to develop it, you know, a lot of filmmakers, including John Carpenter, had been trying to get a remake of Creature from the Black Lagoon up and running, and they could never really get much traction with that. You're not exactly talking a lot about it, about a lot of fish horror, you know, in the 1990s. The 1990s were a mix of psychological thrillers and celebrity horror, right? Stuff like Bram Stoker's Dracula and Silence of the Lambs and Sleeping with the Enemy.
Oh, the co-ed horror too. Like, I Know What You Did Last Summer.
And then the post-scream self-referential.
Yeah.
Postmodern horror, right? Like Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend,
a lot of teams.
The Faculty, yeah. Stuff like that, and that was all tongue in cheek. You know, so you really weren't finding an area where, like, you know, you had like a little blip in the 2000s, a little blip in the early 80s where werewolves were in. You've had large sections where zombies were in or vampires were in. Fish people, you're not going to find a lot of them in film history. You know, you're just so and people in Hollywood, nobody wants to be the person who sticks their neck out on a fish people movie and has it crash.
Well, they could have gone with crab people.
They could have gone with crab people. That's true. Yeah, I mean, just the way that Hollywood works. If you make a vampire film in the early or mid 2000s, rather, or early 2010s, you know, in the Twilight craze. Then the vampire movie bombs, people go, well, I understand they were what was big then, but you stick your neck out on making a film about people having sex with fish people, and the last thing you would think is that it's going to win an Academy Award. So, yeah, it's, you well, know, that's the kind of thing that you lose your job over.
That, you know,
And Lovecraft wasn't like a big name. I mean, his stories have always been cult, I mean, and like big
yeah.
names.
Go on.
But, you know, let's look at films like Tremors, for example. I mean, when you look at it at the surface, it's about movie of giant worms, but it turned out to be such a hit. You know, even Bacon, who starred in it, had his complete doubts about it. But the movie just really nailed with the audience. It's a very obscure kind of scenario, but it worked.
Well, I'm trying to remember if Tremors was a hit. I don't remember its box office.
I would say, I mean, in terms of reception, you know.
Well, right, but for a film like that, that's not one that people go, well, the fans really liked it.
It made $16 million off a budget of $11 million.
Yeah, so it was not enough. Yeah, it was middling. probably did very well on
VHS
on home video. And yeah. So probably did well there. Cause I mean, it did have four sequels, or three sequels in a TV series rather. So, and then now the two recent sequels with a third in the pipeline, you know, coming now. But so clearly it made money somewhere. But it also wasn't something that was like a real surprise hit, like Oh Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which was actually did really, really, really well. And I remember them releasing it. It was released up against Batman. And it was basically counter programming. And they said, hey, you know, if people are going to go to the theater and Batman's going to be sold out, you know, so they're going to look for something else to see. And it ended up making a fortune. And that shocked everybody.
Right. Yeah. And so this one, like you said, got stuck in the back burner, and then eventually they found financing in an obscure place, like Galicia in Spain. And, they get public funding and all that, because a lot of the European countries and Canada, for that matter, give a lot of tax money to the film industry, unlike in the U.S., because their film industries don't have the infrastructure as, say, Hollywood, for example. So at the beginning of this film, you see a bunch of, you know, Galician and television and film Spanish stuff that supported it, besides Lionsgate. I know it's you just never know what is going to be a hit. And when you have producers, they decide what's going to be a hit. They say, no, Fish People aren't going to be a hit. Horror is a hit, but not this type of horror. So, yeah, we don't want to do this film. And then it came. He got it out 15 years after he wanted to do it, which is kind of sometimes how it's done. All right. So, anything else anybody wanted to bring up that isn't spoiler related to this film or Stuart Gordon?
I would like to say that one of the interesting things about this movie is, just related to 2001, which I thought was kind of interesting, is that they actually had like a premiere in Spain. And I guess this was released after 9/11. And one of the big concerns about, you know, the Spain, they were very excited to have this big premiere for this movie. And they were very concerned that the actors were too afraid to fly.
Hmm. And you're absolutely right. It was released literally 1 month after 9/11. It was released October 12th.
Because, you know, I was dating. I had just started dating a guy that worked at the aquarium with me. And I was trying to remember the other day when I was watching this. I'm like, I went to the theater with somebody to see this. Who did I go with? And because I remember seeing it in like not in my hometown, and I was like, oh, my God, that's right. I saw it with Tom at the Paramus, New Jersey, whatever their theater was, because he was a horror movie fan. And that was just interesting because I was like, oh, yeah. So this was after 9/11 because we met. And literally we met and it was like, wow, this is awesome. And then 9/11 happened and he lived in New Jersey and I lived in Connecticut. So we actually did not have our second date until like, oh my God, it was like a month later. It was after the anthrax scare, I think. But I think this was the movie that we went to go see when we finally hooked up for our second date. Oh, well, not like anybody cares, but it's interesting to take that wander down memory lane.
Yeah. No worries. So obviously 9/11 wasn't going to help this film any. I mean, a lot of things in the arts, specifically movies, got hurt big time because of this, because of that terrorist incident. Just for being overshadowed by it, obviously, or other concerns that people had and whatnot. All right, so I guess I'll throw out the spoiler alert. So we will critique and discuss everything and anything related to the film, so spoilers and whatnot, because that is required when we do our dissecting of the film, so to speak.
So if you want to check out the film and not have any story lines, you know, told to you, come back later after you've seen it.
Exactly. Podcasts are here pretty much forever once they're loaded, so you can come back after. All right, so the spoiler's up, so I guess we can discuss. Basically, there's four people on a boat. They're doing like sea diving or something, and two Americans and two Brits. Well, actually, that's not true. One American, two Brits, and one Galician, I guess, or Spanish woman.
They're not really diving, are they? They're just kind of enjoying themselves on the boat.
Yeah, pretty much hanging out and stuff like that.
Right, he has a dream about himself diving.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, he brought his work with him, and it's related to some of the stuff, right? Isn't it related to...
That's all stock market stuff.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
He's really worried about the stock market or his stock going down or up.
Very typical of that period in time, because this is right after the internet boom and there were an awful lot of overnight millionaires who were being made. This very much kind of feels right at home with that.
Right, yeah, right. That's exactly what I was going to say, is that when they had originally written the script in the 80s, I guess it was a completely different setup for how he became rich. And then when they went to do this in, you know, that was during the dot-com boom when they were filming it. And they were like, oh, my God, this is like perfect. Like, we don't even have to do any work. Here's the whole story right here.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Yeah, I mean, everybody at that time knew what that was all about, the ticker and all that on the computer. So just say that, get it over with and whatnot. All right, so the film doesn't really do much other setup, except that his girlfriend isn't interested in him working while they're on vacation. And so she does an absolutely horrible thing, which is throw his computer into the ocean. I was like horrified. I was like, oh my God.
I was too.
Yeah. So yeah, that was bad. And then a storm is seen in the distance and eventually comes to them real quick. Wait.
They hear chanting on the shores.
Yeah.
First.
Mm-hmm.
And then a storm comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right, that's fair too. Yeah.
A 3-hour tour.
Well, that's actually, the fact that they were chanting is actually an important detail there, because I think it's, I'm not sure if it's actually in the story, because I reread the story kind of quickly, but basically these people can summon, they have magical powers that allow them to summon weather to encourage shipwrecks so that they can get their sacrifices for Dagon. So that's kind of important, even though they don't really explain that in the movie. And there's an implication there too, of course, in, you know, the score, even the score itself. The score in this I found to be amazing, because it has this very haunting, like, siren like theme running through it, and this whole idea that maybe she, you know, that the queen there, the princess there, also, you know, was like summoning him to come, so they can summon things, and that's actually a tie-in to the story, you know, Dagon. In fact, they were talking about, when you look at the hole under the ocean that they have, they basically took the monolith in the opening of the short story Dagon and they turned it into a hole instead, because they, I forget the reason why they did it, but if you look at the hole and the way it's got all of the interesting, you know, shapes and symbols in it, and it's dark and all that stuff, it's very, it's supposed to represent the monolith that's in Dagon, which makes total sense.
Right, and they just inverted it.
One thing is, not only is the chanting feel like, it feels like a summoning, not just because of what it, the event that is coming, but because it feels like it's almost for Paul in a way. Everything leading him up to the reveal almost felt like, you know, these characters were brought in by complete chance. But we began to see how things were almost purposely initiated to bring all these people into this place for this major thing.
And that was partly the dreams, right? Because I think some of the dreams he probably had even prior to the beginning of the film, his character, and mm-hmm. and it brought him here. And one interesting thing, if you rewatch the film, at the beginning when he's on the boat, he has no shirt on, and you can see like these black and blue marks on his abdomen, which are very important at the end of the film. So
yeah, I like that they threw that in there all the way to the beginning, and I did take note of it. And I was wondering if they were going to revisit it or not, and they do. So that was cool.
Yeah. Well, and they also mention that, you know, he's having stomach issues and all this kind of stuff, and that he's in pain. You know, we see parts of the movie where he's like in pain or he's gripping his side or whatever, when he actually hasn't been physically accosted or hurt by anything. And that whole thing is the transformation that is taking place in him. And it is, of course, beyond his control because his fate has already been decided. So that's really important to, like I said, that main theme of like identity and, you know, can you escape your genetic code? Can you escape your dreams? How much choice do you really have over the thing that you become? That's very Lovecraft.
And if you're part of the fish person, then it's
it's
going to be a little harder.
That's the part that's really related to the Shadows over Innsmouth, right? I mean, him turning into the other.
Well, yeah, because that is the actual storyline.
Right.
Yeah. Isn't it? Barrett, did you read the story recently? Do you want to talk about it?
Not recently enough to talk really well about it. But yeah, basically at the end of the story, the main character starts to change into one of the fish people, and he has traced his lineage back and sees that he's related, and that's why this is happening to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the fish people in the book, or I should say the two stories, are called the Deep Ones. Yep. And so for folks who've heard that term before, that's where it comes from. It comes from these stories, Dagon and Shadows over Innsmouth.
Here's another thing too.
Go on, Mike.
About finding destiny is another thing. Is that's a common theme throughout a number of the Lovecraft stories, is that a lot of characters are connected to these individuals who are either a found source of power or are transformed, and they themselves are drawn into this kind of hell. And another thing, too, is that these characters, in one way or another, are powerless to face against it. There's no blasting away these creatures or these otherworldly forces with dynamite or something like that in the action movies and stuff like that. These things are so beyond control and stuff like that that the characters are only able to delay the inevitable, or they just completely fall victim to the influence. And even if they don't die, their minds and their worldview is so corrupted that it just wasn't worth escaping in the end. And that's kind of like what basically happens here.
Yeah, exactly. Because in a what is it, a 12-hour period, this guy's life changes completely from normality with a beautiful girlfriend, a good job, a lot of money, and whatnot, to basically the underbelly cult stuff that, you know, you always hear about, especially, you know, from all the 1970s devil worshiping stuff all the way to this film here. It almost implies those type of films, even if it's outer beings or Lovecraftian beings instead of the devil and Christianity.
Well, you know, and there is this whole thing kind of running through there, which is sort of corny, but he keeps talking about, you know, two possibilities, which suggests that he really doesn't have a choice. Like, and he's always aware that he doesn't have a choice. But there is a moment in the film where he really does kind of turn the corner. And you know that at that point, he cannot go back to his old life. In other words, it's when he finds Barbara. It's when he gets reunited with Barbara. That is the last moment that he has any hope of maybe returning to his old life. And I think that they did a good job placing that little scene where it was and giving the audience a breather for a second, just to sort of like, maybe they're going to be okay, you know? And then, of course, everything sort of just hits the fan from there, but.
All right, so we set it up where, yeah, they hear the chanting, then the storm comes in. The town is a small fishing village that they're not really familiar with, just outside off the coast, I mean, from where their boat is. It's secluded and very, if not quote-unquote redneck, very, very rural-like. So think of like Fall River in the 1800s with Moby Dick and all that stuff. It's that type of fishing community. So it's working class and whatnot.
Very run down, decrepit, dirty. It almost feel it's almost like it's rotting. You know, it feels like it's being overtaken by the sea as time goes on.
Right. Well, you go into a hotel room and everything is like all mildewy and moldy.
Not even upkept. And when I say upkept, I'm not talking about repairs. I'm just talking about normal cleanliness, right?
Well, it's abandoned. It essentially looks abandoned. And there is an interesting thing, like in the story, he talks about it, and it's the descriptions, of course, in Lovecraft are always the win. I mean, anybody who's read Lovecraft knows this. His descriptions are just vivid and intense and amazing. And I really think they did an amazing job. Like, when I saw this hotel room, I was like, oh my God, this is exactly what I saw in the story almost. Like, I got that feeling of it from the story. So I think they really took a lot of very important details. And there is that moment with the lock where he takes the lock off of the bathroom door and moves it to the front door, that crappy little lock.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's actually in Shadows Over Innsmouth. They took that whole scene right out of that. That's actually in there. Yeah, where he tries to, where he unscrews the lock and puts it on the front door.
My wife had a laugh at that purposely. Wondering, like, does he really expect that to work? And it's like, well, what else is he going to do? Right? He doesn't have a lot of options. I don't know that I would want to touch the bed. But I think the main thing, and of course, there's a reason for this, right? The main thing is for the state of discrepancy is that it is all unused, that these are people going through the motions. They're pretending to be a normal village, right? And they're not. You know, it's the that's the reason why everything is in a state of disrepair. They're all just kind of going through the motions.
Right. Yeah, no, and that's true. That's true.
But it does make sense considering that these villagers are essentially slowly abandoning it over the years because they have taken up a new residence.
Right, right, right. Yeah, we'll discuss what that is and how it is in the book too. But before we do that, to set it up, because we can probably get quick from the boat to the hotel room, because that was the 15 to 20 minutes that Pam was mentioning, that kind of, and you too, Mike, and even me, kind of wasn't the most exciting part of the movie. Basically, they hit a rock during the storm. The English woman gets her leg stuck, and her husband says he's going to stay with the boat. So our two, what appear to be our leads, Paul and Barbara, take the buoy or whatever to get over to the town, and they meet up with what appears to be a Catholic priest and explains what happened, and the Catholic priest helps them by getting a couple of people, fishermen basically, who had just came back because of the storm, to bring them out. So Barbara stays back on the dock, because obviously the tides are pretty bad, and why, you know, be harmed on the water again to go back to their boat for the rescue. And so what happens is Barbara heads over to the hotel, and she basically gets attacked by the Catholic priest and the man behind the desk. And then they cut from there, and we find out that the English couple that was on the boat waiting for rescue are gone. And so our lead, Paul, comes back with the fisherman, gets off, and heads to the hotel, because that's where he's going to hang out, because the Catholic priest tells him that Barbara had gone to the next town for some reason to get help or something, the police over there or something. So that's pretty much the setup. And then he gets to the hotel, and we already know there's a problem. First off, the fisherman and the Catholic priest act a little odd anyway, but you can, you know, write that off as just small town eccentricity. But then we see Barbara's perspective when she gets basically attacked by the clerk at the hotel and the Catholic priest. We already know that these are bad people. At least the priest is not who he says he is. All right. So is that pretty much the setup? Anybody want to add anything else?
I do love how the little bits of visual cues and stuff like that of the otherworldly nature of everything slowly reveals. Like when Paul sees the priest's hands, he sees wet fingers. When he goes to the hotel, and the guy and the man behind the desk turns his neck around, and we see the gills. We see people covering their faces, or they're limping and moving strangely. I just love how it slowly just makes these really unsettling, distant or very quick shots, just to kind of give you the sense that something's really, really wrong. I did kind of wish Paul kind of acted a little more, you know, freaked out by it, because he was kind of very nonchalant about all these things, some of the things he's seen. It's just like, I don't know. But I did love the practical makeup effects used, because they really make everything just uncanny valley with these mixture of fish and human features.
Right, and it's very subtle, and that was something I wanted to bring up too, is that you get a lot of very subtle, I mean, you obviously have the more overt things like the fish gills, or webbed fingers, but everyone has this sort of clammy look to them, like they're sick, right. They're pale. The innkeeper, whatever, the hotel clerk, they've shaved his eyebrows off, so he just looks a little odd to begin with. Okay. So yeah, they're just little details like that, when later we meet one character, she's just, her eyes are always like kind of wide open, right? And she never blinks. You know, sort of little details like that to give everyone the sense that they're just a little off. They're just not right. But it's right. But other than a few touches, most of it isn't really overt, at least not at first.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really like about it is that it's not overt, and it's just kind of, it starts slowly and slowly and slowly, and then all of a sudden it is overt. And I like that, how it leads up to that.
Also, I liked how the character did act, Abe, because he sees these weird things, but, you know, I mean, the people, at this point, he doesn't know that there's an issue with the town. So what's he going to say? You know, like, gee, why do you have webbed fingers? Or why do you have those cuts on your neck? You know, it's like when you see someone with a disability, you may look or double take, but you're never going to ask, gee, why do you shake? Well, or why do you have this?
This is right after he also finds the bloody gown in the boat. And he's actually very calm about the very fact that the people he was with just not too long ago are dead.
Well, that's a fair point. Yeah, because the two English folks aren't in the boat, so he assumes they've been lost at sea. And, yeah, I would think that would be horrible, because based off of what he said, some of the exposition between him and Barbara earlier on the boat, they were very much good friends with the English folks. So that's a good point, Abe.
No, as he said, because he, you know, I would think he'd be getting much more unnerved after seeing that, because, you know, he's like, wow, my girlfriend's not around here. The two people we were just with are pretty much probably dead, lost at sea. And all these weird people who won't communicate with me or just look really off. I think he's kind of acting more annoyed than he is distressed.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because how would someone act when two of their friends have disappeared and are presumed lost at sea only like 20 minutes
prior?
Seems
way too calm for it, but
yeah.
I kind of glossed over it. But yeah, he definitely seems more calm than he should at that point.
Right, yeah, right. He probably should have been more hysterical and stuff. But then again,
or depressed or something, right?
Well, but then again, there is an interesting thing here. If you read many of Lovecraft's stories, most of the time, and you know, I'm certain there are people out there who know Lovecraft way better than I do, but most of the time, his characters are, it's first person, it's somebody telling a story about, I went to this town and I saw this thing. And, you know, usually they're like scientists or researchers or something like that. And so they are, in general, very emotionless people. If you look at the main character, the narrator in The Color Out of Space, not the Nahum character, but if you read the actual story, the character in The Color Out of Space that is doing the narrating, he is the guy who's going there to do a survey, and he's like, oh, I showed up at this town and things were weird, and then I met this weird old guy, and this weird old guy told me this weird story, and here it is. So a lot of times you do get, the character is extremely distanced emotionally. And that's also interesting to note as well, because Lovecraft was really not a warm and fuzzy person. He had very strong opinions. Not only was he a xenophobe, which we're not going to go into because that's just a whole can of worms we're not going to touch right now, but he had a mother who was very like controlling, but didn't really dole out, I don't think, unless I'm mistaking, the love that he really needed. In fact, the first time that he really felt anything like love and actually had any physical relations with anybody was when he married his wife. So, you know, we're talking about a guy here who is writing in the first person, and he's sort of modeling all these characters on himself. So you are going to get an emotionally distanced individual. And I agree with you guys. He should be freaking out. He should be losing his mind. He is. created in the opening of this story as a nervous person, you know, as a nervous, creative, kind of jumpy person, checking his stocks every 20 minutes, you know. And he's also a reluctant hero. But I think maybe they were trying to faithfully give the Lovecraft vibe, and so that's why they didn't do that. Because it seems like rarely Lovecraft's characters do they freak out.
Well, the thing is, too, is that a lot of the characters that are the main characters, guys, I've read some of his stories as well, are usually people of reason and stuff like that. But Paul, he's kind of this really dorky, off his balance, kind of a workaholic and stuff like that. He doesn't feel like a very calm fellow to begin with, in the sense that those characters, and especially, you know, I think he kind of flips flops sometimes. Like sometimes he kind of shows the unhinged moments of falling out of reason, and other times he comes off as the clumsy average Joe. You know, like he's trying to climb up with a bow and he's barely getting on there, or he's fighting off these fish people with his cell phone and stuff like that. He never came off as a kind of guy who matches those individuals who try to remain calm for the most part.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I would completely agree with that, Abe. I would absolutely 100% agree with that. I was just saying that there might have been a reason that they did that.
I agree. I just maybe had to do with Godin's performance, perhaps. Perhaps it was just a little, because sometimes he actually gets much better towards the second act.
Yeah.
But the first part, he's very kind of like he's trying to get a feel for his character.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, the moment he gets to the hotel, where he thinks Barbara's off to the next town to call the police about what has occurred with the boat, and his two friends have gone. At that point, right when he gets to the hotel, that's when the character becomes very realistic. How he acts based off of what he sees, what's happening to him, and all that other stuff. Yeah,
I agree. I wanted to mention one thing about the beginning of the film and why I was kind of surprised that I liked it as much as I did. It kind of had an 80s feel to it to me. Mm. I was like, this film was made in 2001, but it kind of feels a little dated to me.
I definitely agree, because I was kind of surprised I saw the date, because I thought it was an older film at first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same here. I thought it was an older film, and I
it's
felt
19
it,
years old. So just
you have a point. But the only thing that really brought me back into it was that, hey, he's got a computer there and it's a laptop. And then I realized, okay, it's more modern than it seems.
Well, but, going back to a recurring theme on the Dark Discussions podcast, which is that we're old, except for Abe. It's just weird to me to think that it has been 19 years since this movie came out, which means it's actually closer in history to 1985 than it is to where we are now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, even though the fact that it has a laptop and digital effects, we want to tend to put it, and it's made in 2001, we want to put it as a modern film. You know, historically, it's actually got closer to Ghostbusters than it is to The Invisible Man.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I know. Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, we're still looking at 2001 as because of our perspective, not
meaning we're old.
Yeah, exactly. Because we still remember it and all that. And now we're like, holy smokes, yeah, you're right. It's 19 years old. So someone that's 19 now would say, what are you talking about? That's a wicked old film. You know, because that was the year I was born. You know, so, but you're right. Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, kind of crazy. We're old. It's depressing. All right. So what scenes do we want to talk about? I mean, we kind of talked about the hotel room a little bit, and general weird things that happened to him before we got to the hotel. I guess the movie really just goes into kinetic craziness at that moment when he gets to into the hotel room. He finds out the place is a dump. He's about to call the front desk to complain because phone doesn't work. And then he hears noise out in the square down below the window, and he sees all these people coming to the square, and they're all effed up, basically.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool scene. I love the moment where all of them just turn and start. You can hear him slowly advancing up the stairs, and he's desperately trying to lock and secure himself. And it just becomes a complete moment of chaos. He just can't seem to stop him. He's confused. I kind of got a chuckle when he hears him at the door. And he's like, "Can I help you?" I was like thinking, "Just be quiet, shut up." Yeah, but it definitely goes right into kinetic energy, because no sooner after he's being chased out of the hotel, he's jumping out of the window. And he's in the freaking tanning warehouse. Oof,
right.
That's a creepy scene too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
well,
that's
interesting, that whole tanning thing. Because that is one of the things that they did add to the movie and the script. It is not in the original stories, either of them. And it was basically added for the purposes of
they're leaving their human skin to become the fish people.
Correct. To illustrate the point that while these people are going through their transformations, because their bones are becoming softer, that's why they walk like that. This is why you're seeing little things here and there that are sort of fish-like showing up on their bodies. And stuff like that. The reality is they need the human skins to sort of keep them protected until that time when they can fully return to the ocean. And it's never made clear what that timeline really is. Like, is it after this sacrifice? Is there a certain time that it becomes complete? I don't think they
are. Yeah, because there was a moment where, God, I'm going to keep butchering her name. Uxia, something like that?
Ushia.
Okay, Ushia mentions that there had been a sacrifice for years. So, yeah, the timeline in terms of, you know, when they start transforming to their final forms is never, you know, made, you know, it feels kind of weird. It's kind of left in the dark.
Maybe this was just in my head, but I was kind of under the impression that, you know, they were all in different stages. And that some of them had already maybe transitioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
no,
I
agree with you.
This has been going on for something like 70 years.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, there are no old people in the village that we see. So I had just the sense that, like, that first generation had moved. And this is their children or their grandchildren that are changing over. You know, and they're all in different states and different stages. So it all depends on, I don't know, how devoted a follower you are, maybe, or whatever it is, or just dumb luck of genetics. But some are more advanced than others. Obviously, the head of the town is almost completely gone. The priestess has completely lost the ability to walk. So, you know, it's like, and whereas the hotel clerk has gills and the priest just has some webbed fingers. So I didn't think that there was waiting for one grand mass migration. I got the sense that this was going to be a cycle.
Quick question, though, is the priestess different in the fact that she is a child of Dagon directly? It sounds like.
Well,
yeah.
Is he? I thought she was the daughter of Octopus Face. What's his name?
You're right. Yeah.
Xavier Caro.
You're right.
Yeah, because he calls Paul his son and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's right. She's a child of the village elder.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They're half. They're gonna. Doesn't she say?
They have different point, mothers.
We're gonna be together forever, as you know, as basically as husband and wife, and we're also brother and sister, but like you said, Barrett, from just different mothers.
They just seem different than the others to me, the way they're transitioning. I don't know. That's the sense I got.
It feels like a more cleaner transformation, because they all feel deformed. While she can't walk anymore. Hers is more defined in terms of her structure. The guys and the village elder looks more complete in terms of his structure, but I think he only remains there because he is in charge. So he can't really complete his leaving because he has a role to fulfill.
I could see the different forms of the people as they transform. It could be slower for a lot of them, and this is just based off of, a theory, because you have the original members of the town that got corrupted were half fish, half human, but as the genes are split up, you know, you could have someone that's only 1/8 fish and married to another 1/8 fish. And so their children would only be 1/8 as well. So, you know what I'm saying? So some people were probably half fish right from the day they were born, while others were less. You know, it's similar to like a lot of people in the United States where, you know, you have two parents that are half, one's half Italian, half Irish, another one's half Russian and half Japanese. Their children are going to be a quarter of all those things and on, it just keeps on diluting, right? So I think that could be the case here. Some of them were actually half fish while others weren't.
I can't help but think of Garrison from South Park. You're going to be a retarded fish baby. But yeah, it's a weird kind of cycle because it's never clear how, because it looks very close knit, but we don't know how many of the village has left. Because we still see large crowds of them gathered in the square. We see a large crowd of them gathered at the ceremony. Of course, a number of them were killed off too over the course of the film too. So it's never an idea of like is this village in its death throes or what?
Well, and part of the point too is it's this idea of evolution sort of going backwards. You know, I mean, Lovecraft, honest to God, had no love for humanity in general. At least according to some biographers I've heard talk about him and some academics. I've actually never read a good biography of Lovecraft, so I don't know much about his philosophy or his way of living. But what I have picked up is that he really was not loving of the masses, not loving of humanity, really thought that they were kind of, you know, kind of stupid and whatever. So we almost in this story sort of see that that sort of opinion of his come through, in that this is evolution in reverse, that if humanity keeps going the way it's going, it might as well just go ahead, you know, and become these thoughtless sort of like brainless things that just go back to the ocean for once they came. I mean, you know, when Lovecraft was writing this too, I think there was a lot about, Mike, you would know about this. Was this like when they were talking about evolution around the time that Lovecraft was alive, or was that way before? Like my history is way off on
that. I mean, this is going to be around the time of maybe when they were debating genetics versus evolution, before they realized you got the modern synthesis of putting the two together.
Okay, Shadows Over Innsmouth was published in 1923. Was it 23? Yeah, I think it was 2023.
Yeah, this is also going to be around the time of the Scopes trial.
That's what I was asking. Like, okay, so that clearly would have probably had an influence on this then. Maybe.
It's certainly possible.
Because it's all about, you know, Go ahead.
For folks who are listening to this have no idea what you're talking about Scopes trial. What's that about?
That's the Scopes monkey trial. Kind of, sort of what Inherit the Wind is based off of. But it was the idea of where they was it Kentucky or Tennessee?
Tennessee.
Where Tennessee had passed a law that said you couldn't teach evolution in schools. And so John Scopes was a substitute teacher who more or less agreed to take a job, teach evolution, to get arrested and prosecuted so they could do this show trial to challenge the law. It's really kind of what happened. And originally at the time, the three most famous or most popular public speakers in the United States were Helen Keller, Clarence Darrow, and why can't I think of his name now? The guy who ran for president multiple times and was represented the other side.
Republican or Democrat?
Democrat.
Stevenson?
No.
Adlai Stevenson?
No. Stevenson's much later. He was a firebred populist and deeply religious man.
Upton Sinclair?
No. Anyway, oh man, this is killing me that I can't think of the guy's name right now. But anyway, so these were so obviously Helen Keller was involved in the trial. So this is basically between the two of the most famous people in the country. William Jennings Bryan, that's it. William Jennings Bryan ends up representing the prosecution, and Clarence Darrow ends up representing the defense. And he's actually their number two pick. It was originally going to be H.G. Wells, oddly enough, was going to come in and argue the case. But yeah, so it ends up becoming a big show trial to argue evolution versus creationism being taught in schools. And it was basically done in stage because they realized it was going to happen. The town was in bad financial straits because you're in the Depression. And I think, where's this when you're in the Depression? Oh, it's before the Depression. But they basically did it because if somebody was going to do it, they may as well get the business from it. And so, which is why this whole thing ends up being staged.
Gotcha.
John Scopes served about an afternoon in jail.
Gotcha. All right, so let's get back to the film. We've already been recording for about an hour and 30 minutes, so we should probably start focusing on the major things that happen in the film near the end. Who wants to – Barrett, why don't you explain the backstory about the town? Because what happens is he escapes from the tannery where he finds the male friend.
Yeah.
A corpse or skin, so he knows he was murdered by the town, and he gets under
it's like a dock, isn't it?
Yeah, a dock or something.
Yeah. And he threatens that guy with his little knife.
Yeah, so explain. So the guy explains
this
that
guy
he's
is
actually,
like. Yeah. He was hard for me to understand, so I may not have gotten this entirely correct. Right.
I had to put on the
subtitles. Same thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I didn't even think about doing that. But, so this guy tells him the story, and I guess this guy's still human from the way he talks. He hasn't been...
He actually
been...
says he's... Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the last human, full human in the town, he says.
Because he's a drunk and he's loco.
Right. And he tells him that all of his friends are dead, right? Basically. And then he proceeds to tell him about the story of the town. And that's where it gets a little hazier for me. I know at one point they start getting all of the gold out of the sea because they start the people start worshiping Dagon, right?
Yep.
And once they start getting the gold, they start worshiping Dagon. And then at some point they turn on anyone that doesn't worship Dagon and they kill them all. And it ends with them destroying the church and defacing the church and killing the priest in the church. But then the gold stops coming and the city starts falling apart. And so they start doing these sacrifices of people to Dagon. trying to get
and that's where they start sacrificing. That's where they sacrifice his parents,
right?
Who refuse to give up their Christianity.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, the film's actually fairly graphic in its destruction of the Christian, the Catholic Church. That basically the cultists break into the Catholic Church and they start killing people, and they literally rip down statues and crosses, and they take sledgehammers to them. So I was kind of shocked. It's like, holy smokes.
I kind of liked how I couldn't necessarily completely understand the guy, because it felt more real to me. It felt like he was telling a story that actually occurred to him. You know, it just felt better to me that I couldn't completely understand that he was a little more.
It was a really strong scene. It was a really strong scene. And I really liked the character a lot. It was so, you know, even with the need of subtitles, I still found him very likable, and him helping Paul was one of the few moments where we can see humans holding on to humanity, stuff like that. In fact, he's the character that represents that one of those struggles in there, especially his face.
It kind of inspires Paul, right? I mean, because he holds on to his humanity so long, and then, you know, eventually is killed. I think that kind of inspires the other guy to fight for longer than he probably would have otherwise.
Yeah, and I think there's a very dark theme of the idea that the people who defy these beings and stuff like that, these dark religions, only can hold on to them through death. You know, we have Ezekiel, you know, hold on to his faith to the very end. Vicky, who defies giving birth to the child through death. It's just like the only escape is through losing your life to escape a fate worse than what awaits, you know, when you die. Because oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Nope. Finish.
Oh, and so basically, it's this kind of thing of, you know, trying to escape from almost an eternity that you wish to avoid.
Yeah, and there's an interesting thing here too, because, you know, Lovecraft is the last line of Shadows Over Innsmouth is a very eerie, almost parody of the 23rd Psalm. This is not an original thought. There's a very well-known, like the most notable Lovecraftian scholar in the world who got this from one of his mentors. But that's why I think Stuart Gordon made use of the 23rd Psalm in that scene with the death, which I will talk about, because there's also a huge parallel in this going on to the Wicker Man in terms of the movie. And that was done on purpose. Hmm. If you listen to any of the commentaries and stuff, they talk about that deliberately on purpose. They chose this village because it reminded them of the Wicker Man.
See, now I'm going to have to get the Blu-ray.
Oh my God, there's so much good stuff on there. Holy crap. You will learn so much stuff. It is probably, both of the commentaries are probably some of the best I've ever heard. They really give you a lot of detail, and that's where it becomes very apparent that this was totally a labor of love. They busted their asses to make sure everything was just right.
So let's get into, the part where he gets into the mansion, or which is the town elder or the mayor's house, and he meets Ushia. And then after that, we can talk about, the two last big scenes, which are when he gets captured and the first incredible death, and then the second one, which is the second scene, which is the cult sacrifice, and then we have the second incredible death for this film. Let's get into that. Who wants to talk about the mansion and all that?
So, okay, I can do that. So basically what happens is that Paul asks Ezekiel you know, because basically as a hostage, it's like, either I kill you or I trust you. And Ezekiel, without having to be told, actually goes right up and starts distracting the guys watching over the car of the village elder. However, that entire plan goes tits up because Paul accidentally gets the horn going and has to run to the house to escape the bodyguards, or whatever you want to call them. And as he's evading these pursuers, he finds himself in the room of Uzia, who's just sitting in bed. And she actually protects him from being captured. And there's a moment where her father is comes checking on her, and some dialogue between them. She doesn't sell out Paul, and it seems like Paul's safe for the moment, and Paul immediately recognizes her as the girl he's been seeing in his dreams. And he gets pulled in, and they start kissing, and even though he initially resists, until suddenly he discovers gills on her torso, and when he removes the sheets, she has these two long tentacle-like appendages where her limbs, her lower limbs should have been, which frightens him off, and he escapes, and tries to flee, which leads to continued pursuit, where he ends up in another house and is attacked by, I think, the mother of a child, who has this huge fuck off tentacles and starts beating the shit out of him, and he manages to knock her out, but he doesn't get very far until he's shot in slow motion by his net. I kind of had a nice little chuckle of him slowly just kind of collapsing with the over him. But unfortunately, his escape from the villagers is cut short, and that's where we get into the next scene.
Right. Yep. All right. So the next scene, he finds out that his girlfriend is still alive, and she had been captured and been put into this. So it's like a holding room in like a warehouse. And then he also finds Vicky, who was the woman, the English woman, and she's still alive too. But she has had her leg amputated due to the injury that she had on the boat where it was lodged between the rock that they hit and parts of the bow of the boat. And then there's a couple of one other person too, the old man, right?
Ezekiel, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so what do we want to talk about this scene? And I guess the defacing scene. This part,
I was going to say, there's a scene in the past that we kind of glossed over, is where the guy from the ship, his older friend, they have his face on, right?
Oh, yeah, they find his skin's hanging. Yeah.
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 I did mention that.
You did, Phil, but Barrett, can you just like maybe just tell the listeners in like one sentence or something what that is, like where he goes into the tannery, what he actually finds? Because I think we all got so excited, and then I jumped in and said a bunch of crap that really wasn't connected. So,
can you
clarify that so everybody knows? Because this is important. This is, you know what I mean? This particular moment we're going to talk about, you really need to understand what the prior moment was about before you can get this.
Well, he goes into that tannery, and eventually they're coming in after him to try and get him, and that's when one of the guys has his friend's face on him, and it really freaks him out, and that's, you know, that causes him to really run away. Is what part are you thinking of as far as that's really important?
Well, that's it, that we understand that they are peeling people's faces off.
Yeah.
And we do understand that, but it's so well done in that, like Phil said, yeah, there's gore, but I'm not a gore hound. I actually do not like excessive gore. I find it unnecessary. And yet I thought the gore in this film was well done. I didn't, even the really gross stuff, I didn't feel was overdone. I thought it was just right.
Well, and it was just long enough for him to see it for you to go, oh my God, and then he's running away.
Yeah, so yeah. It's like close up and vomit for 5 minutes. Yeah, no, like a lot of places do, like a lot of films do. But anyway.
But I definitely think it's important for us for the next scene that you're about to talk about, Phil, is that they've already kind of shown that faces are getting taken off of people, and now they're going to actually do it, you know, in front of us and show us it being done.
Right, right. Yeah, I actually was shocked how far they went. But then again, this is a Stuart Gordon film. I mean, he said, you know, Reanimator shocked everybody 15 years earlier. They're going to take off the face of the old man and our lead. And we actually see them do it to the old man, Ezekiel.
It's an impressive scene, like graphic.
Oh, yeah.
It's really impressive.
It's a very visceral scene. I mean, it's very heartbreaking too, because it's the very moment where Ezekiel has, you know, he feels like he's about to die. He has managed to salvage some of himself in that moment, and the two recite this prayer together as he's fighting through the pain. It's a very brutal, dark scene. In fact, as I said, if it came out this year, this would be really up there, because it's just like, it's so well done, but it's just the right amount of gore, and it's just the amount of good, strong performance between the two the characters' presence. Just very well done.
My toes literally curled. That's how I know when something is gross, when I'm sitting there barefoot and like my toes are going, and I'm digging into the rug or whatever it is. Like, gross.
Oh, I got goosebumps.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking. I guess this one was probably even more shocking than the next death that we talk about, because I don't think we've seen anything really much like this in films before, at least I don't remember. But I mean, we've seen you know, like Leatherface and stuff in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but that's after the fact, right? It's not actually us seeing the face being peeled off,
right?
Mike, was this the one that you were thinking was the?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So what happens here? He escapes, right? He takes out the priest, who's actually a Dagon priest, not a Catholic priest, and a couple of henchmen as well. And he's going off to find Barbara at this point.
Let's talk about that scene, though, with him with the knives, because I think that's a great scene where his acting is really well done. He just kind of goes a little crazy, and he's just stabbing people left and right. I really enjoyed that scene.
Yeah, that was the very moment where he's hitting the tipping point of his sanity.
Yeah, oh yeah, he snapped in a sense. Yeah, I mean, when you see the old man getting killed for nothing, basically, and he knows he's about to go next, he even screams. He says, "Just do it," you know, at one point, because you know, he's dead. And he knows it, but he escapes and he takes out the mall, and that was awesome. So let's talk about the cult scene. So he gets down to where they're going to sacrifice Barbara, and Ushir is actually leading the sacrifice.
They're not going to sacrifice her so much,
right?
Right, which is what we found out about Vicky.
Yep.
Is that, like, when she was on the boat, we saw this black fluid come in, and apparently that's Dagon seminal fluid.
That's right.
Because we're gonna see it again in just a few minutes. So that's Dagon's black semen. And so Dagon had impregnated Vicky and now wants to impregnate Barbara.
Well, and Vicky killed herself, right? She stabbed herself so she wouldn't have the
child,
the spawn.
Yeah. which really is an appropriate term in this case, I think.
Spawn, it's a better term, I agree.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and this one here, yeah, you get to see Barbara naked, and she's one fine looking woman, I say.
I think it's kind of hampered the fact she's covered in blood and cuts, though.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right, because Ushia basically is using this like weird, like ceremonial shell to cut like symbols into her skin.
Yeah, I'm sure some of them were also just out of spite because Ushia hates Barbara for being close to Appal.
That's true. That was a fair point. Yep. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because she does say at one point earlier in the film, the priestess, you still have feelings for her or you care for her. I think that's what she says. She says, you care for her. And that seems to really upset her and sort of up the ante a little bit. You know, it kind of strengthens, you know, her resolve to, like, I think, destroy Barbara.
I said, I agree.
Yeah, she's very jealous.
Oh, yeah.
And did you guys know that the fish monster at the end, the guy with all the, like, the guy that they do kind of the close-up at the end, did you know that's Richard Stanley?
Who? That was the mayor of the town. Who's Richard Stanley?
Oh, Richard Stanley?
Yeah, he's uncredited. But it's Richard Stanley.
Who's Richard Stanley?
Richard Stanley, director of Color Out of Space, director of Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, he is uncredited. But if you do a little Googling online, that is definitely him. He plays the fish monster. They say it's the fish monster, so I'm assuming it's that dude at the end. Her dad or whatever, the one that where she goes, oh, he was very handsome and he used to like bring women here and stuff.
Yeah, because the only other fish monster is CGI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we do see most of the people who are half fish. That's all practical effects. But you're right, Mike. This one was most certainly practical effects and it was pretty impressive.
Well, yeah, the rest of them I would just describe as fish people.
Yeah.
You know, there's only two that I could really maybe accept as fish monsters. One is the head of the town.
Yep.
And one is the what I'm assuming is supposed to be Dagon at the very end.
Well, and here's the thing. This is what she says, Barrett. She says to him regarding Barbara, because he says, save her, right? I'll do anything you want, just save her. She says, Dagon needs a sacrifice. You cannot care for her. You do not dream of her. You dream of me.
Yep.
That is what she says. So she's definitely like, you don't. And again, Barbara is his former self, and the High Priestess represents his new self, which he embraces at the end of the film. But yeah, so they're going to sacrifice. Oh, I know what I wanted to say. So in one of the commentaries, they talk about why they did the Dagon monster with the tentacles and they just did it as CGI. They really felt that they could not do the monster appropriate justice and they would have spent too much energy, time, and money to try to get it to be as spectacular as the audience would have been expecting it to be. And they felt that the payoff wouldn't have been good. So they decided instead to go with just show a little of it, do some CGI, and we're going to spend all the time, money, and energy on things like the set, things like, you know, other details. And I honestly, I think they made the right choice, even though we don't really, I think it is better left to our imagination.
Sure.
But you know, in Lovecraft's earlier work, he barely describes anything. Like, it's all like, it's this horrible, hideous thing. Oh my God, it's this terrifying thing. You know, it's not until we get toward the end of his life. Right.
Your mind can't comprehend it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's his famous line. Your mind cannot comprehend what you see. Okay. Like, oh, no description, no nothing. It's not till later on that we start getting in his career that we start getting into the tentacles and the, you know, the urchin and all that, whatever. But, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so let's talk about the final thing. So Dargon kills Barbara in the second, her effort death, which is ripping off her arm. So he obviously ain't going to be using her as a concubine after all, because she ain't going to survive that. But let's talk about the finale, right? Which is the cameo for Richard Stanley, but also when he finds out his, his destiny, right?
Yeah, he finds out. By the way, I do laugh because I understand they're wearing these. In theory, they're wearing these
skins.
These skins to hide their humanity, and it's not really working here. He's just covered in several faces, and it just doesn't work at all. He failed his costuming role badly. But that said, so he's the village elder, and therefore is the one who's progressed the most. Is that devolved the most, changed the most? And he is the father of Uxtia, and he reveals that he's had a long lost son and recognizes our lead as, in fact, that long lost son come home. And that is where we now see and recognize those bruises, or seeming bruises from the beginning of the film, are in fact his beginning of his gills, yeah. I suppose. And that also means that he's the woman he's been dreaming of has been his sister, but you know,
hey, half sister. Come on,
it's a small town, so it doesn't really matter. She's still into him, because what other options does she have?
Indeed. Yeah. And the thing is, like we said, we get the Richard Stanley cameo, and obviously he's covered with makeup, and it's practical effects. It looks like a mind flayer, right? Which is based off of Cthulhu, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see some like tentacles. You get the or insinuation of tentacles. Both coming out of his hood and out of his sleeves, because it looks like he's walking with a cane, and so like if you look at the cane, there's tentacles kind of wrapped around the top of the cane.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, through his cuff of his jacket. Yeah. And so we find out that he's turning into a fish, and he's actually from this village. And those black and blue marks on his torso that we saw at the beginning, if you're lucky, you picked it up. You did, Mike. Are turning into like gills and stuff on him.
And he doesn't embrace who he is until after he's pushed into the water, which Stuart Gordon, it's either Stuart Gordon or the writer on one of the commentaries literally says, I did not like the choice that we made here. And I wish we could have changed it, because in the story, the main character chooses to join the dark gods, whereas here she pushes him to stop him from burning.
Right.
Because the lighter in this is a symbol of, the top side, the world, you know.
Well, his girlfriend, certainly, because it's her lighter.
Right. And she represents like all that is his life, you know. So he makes the choice to try to stay in the light, so to speak, by immolating himself. But the high priestess gets hysterical and pushes him into the water, which quenches him. And then he, you know, discovers. And I thought the burn makeup in that was really good. I don't know. Oh. Maybe you guys don't think so because I don't watch as much of this stuff as you do. But I thought that
it was good.
Yeah,
it was good.
Other than the lips, I thought it was good.
Yeah, the practical effects in this movie were really well done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that was the one change, too, I noticed, too, Chrissy, where he fights becoming the member of the Deep Ones in this movie by burning himself versus in the book where he becomes a defeatist almost and then accepts it and is actually looking forward to it.
Yes, and then embraces it, which is where you get that whole Psalm 23 thing at the end. And just like in The Wicker Man, in that scene where Ezekiel's getting his face ripped off, he is reciting Psalm 23 just like the main character does in 1973 version of The Wicker Man at the end. It's the same, except he's singing it, I think. He's doing the hymn version of it, but in The Wicker Man. But anyway... that again, that's not my original thought. That's all in the commentary. So, anybody who is a serious fan of either this film, Stuart Gordon, or Lovecraft, you really need to just spend the $27 and get this Blu-ray. It's totally worth it. You're going to learn so much. Yeah.
Did you just buy it this week, Chrissy?
Yeah, I did. I just bought it this week.
Yeah.
And there was some stuff I already knew because I had read the stories a couple, you know, and I've read some stuff about Lovecraft. But then listening to them talk about the things they did, particularly on the commentaries, is kind of what really solidified things for me. I also noticed, too, which nobody mentioned in anything, but, you know, this whole idea of keys and locks. There's a lot of close-ups on keys and locks, and keys and locks are symbols of discovery. They're symbols of opening doors you should not open. You know, metaphorically. So here, I think in this movie, there's at least three or four times there's a close up on a key or a lock. And to me, that just sort of said, okay, so there's a discovery coming. This guy doesn't have all the pieces yet. And of course, we do learn it's about his identity and who he really is. But also, you know, they are symbols of, you know, going to the shadow worlds, right? Unlocking the other side. And of course, the depths of the ocean are a shadow world to us. Just like hell, we don't know what's there. You know, not really. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, I really don't. I don't know. Go ahead. I've talked enough.
No. I was just going to say that. Yeah, I ordered it too, but mine is coming like next week because of the delay with coronavirus that, you know, the prime isn't really prime right now. So,
No, it's not. Unless it's my understanding, unless it's essential stuff.
Yeah.
And this is not?
I ordered.
Yes, it is.
Did you explain to them you had a podcast to do, damn it?
I ordered fabric sanitizer, expecting that there would be a delay. And it's like I ordered it this morning. It's coming tomorrow. So they are definitely like prioritizing things that are necessary for people to like survive.
Right.
Just listeners, you know what? Just beware. DVDs, books, shit like that. It's just going to be late. You're just going to
This one I had on my radar for since it came out on that special edition. 18 months ago or whatever. But after watching Vestron, which is basically Lionsgate, so the people that did Chopping Mall. So I ordered it because I liked the movie enough that I said, oh, yeah, I want to see all the features and hear the commentaries and all that. So I have it coming. All right, so let's give our final thoughts on the film. And Stuart Gordon, if you want to add anything about him as well, we can do it. So let's start with you, Chrissy, since, again, you chose the film.
Oh, well, I really enjoyed this film. I was really happy to reengage with it 19 years later and discover that it really it really floated my boat, and because I was so disappointed 19 years ago. And I really think it's because A, I had no experience with Lovecraft at the time. And B, I was really expecting something else. Like, I think I was almost expecting a scary killer fish movie or something. I don't think I was expecting, I don't think I was expecting what I got. And there's a lot in this film to unpack. So if you like to think deeply, there's definitely stuff there. You know, even Dagon itself is a real god in the Bible. You can look for a lot of symbols like the Christian fish that are kind of warped. And in fact, a lot of things in the Dagon religion were adopted for Catholicism, like eating fish on Fridays and stuff like that. So there's a lot of stuff to unpack. I'm just going to say, I think it's great. I do agree with the guys. I think there's some really cheesy acting in this. If you really don't like gore, honestly, I can't stand gore. I really didn't find this too bad at all. I think they did the right balance here. Yes, it's gory, but I think it's appropriate for, the tone of the story. So I'm going to say at least rent this. You know, you don't have to go spending $28 on the DVD unless you know you love it. But this is I think it's really worth your time, particularly if you're a fan of Lovecraft, a fan of Stuart Gordon, or a fan of, I forget whatever the other thing was I said earlier. Anyway, I love it. Go see it.
All right. Very good. Barrett.
I really enjoyed this film. Like I said, during the commentary, I was a little unsure because it felt a little cheesy at first, but it really ended up being a great movie. It has some great practical effects, and the storyline is pretty well done, and the pacing is well done. If you like Lovecraft, I think you'll like this movie, and you should see it. I actually just ordered it because now I want it on disc, even though I bought it in SD on Prime. I'd like to have the Blu-ray version as well. So thank you for including me in this discussion. I appreciate it. And it was a great, great discussion.
Yeah, great. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, you should totally come back.
Thank you.
Yep, absolutely. All right, let's go with you, Abe.
So I really enjoyed this film. I thought, there was a lot of love put into this film, a lot of effort. You know, if you can put aside the dated digital effects and some of the cheesy acting, there's a lot of good in this film. There's some really some dark and eerie moments, great atmosphere, a good soundtrack. One of the best kills I've seen in a horror movie for a long time. And it's just really, it's entertaining. I think once it gets into high gear at the hotel, the movie really does finally get a good running speed, and it really just really shows what you can do. I definitely recommend checking it out. This and The Mouth of Madness, if you love Lovecraft, are both very fun films. If you're also curious, you can also read up on Lovecraft's actual stories as well if you want. They're not going to be for everybody, but if you're interested in what the source material was like, go and check it out.
Oh, if I can just jump in before someone gives one more opinion about the film. If you do want to check out the Lovecraft stories and you do not want to spend any money right now, or you don't want to order them from Amazon or whatever, you can just Google Shadow over Innsmouth. It is available on PDF, reliable versions, because it is a lot of it's public domain, and Dagon. So you can find a lot of Lovecraft short stories online right now that you can just download as a free PDF or read them on your computer or whatever. So it is out there. You do not have to spend money in order to have access to those texts. Sorry, I'll shut up now.
Am I correct? Was Innsmouth a, because I really haven't read a lot of Lovecraft since college, but wasn't Innsmouth a short novella?
Yeah, it's more of a novella.
Yeah, it's more of a novella.
It's like 30, I don't know, it's pretty, it's lengthy. It's not, but I mean, it goes fast. It's not like a boring thing. I mean, it's pretty good.
So. No, but a lot, when me, Abe, Kevin Letts and Barrett were looking to do some Lovecraft stories. We chose four, and one of them is as long as Carrie by Stephen King. Innsmouth and Whisper for the Dark were both like 100 pages each. And yeah. Then that last one was The Thing on the Doorstep, which was like 60 something pages. So we're not talking like 10 page short stories. These are much.
Thing
much
on the Doorstep
larger.
Was that long?
That's wow. Crazy.
Yeah, and that one I know I read that one, and yeah, that didn't seem that long to me. All right, yeah, okay. So. Yeah,
go on, Mike. Yeah, so Mike, give your final thoughts. Yeah.
So my final thoughts, I think it's, look, I'm not going to lie, I think it's a very shaky, what is it, 20 minutes?
Yeah, first 20 minutes.
Yeah. Especially, it's not necessarily any better knowing kind of where it's going to be going. But I think once you get there, there's a lot of really good stuff. I pointed out the sound design. Which I think is very effective for much of it. The makeup is really solid. I very much do enjoy the actor who I guess passed away before the film was released, because
yes,
the Francisco
Emphysema.
Rebel, because he gets a memorial statement at the end of it. I'm not going to say it's my favorite film by Stuart Gordon. I still love Reanimator. I still love From Beyond, and actually probably still enjoy Dolls more. But I think as Lovecraft adaptations go, and what people think of as Lovecraft, I think this would make an interesting double feature with Color Out of Space, because cosmic horror and deep horror tend to be the two things that Lovecraft really specialized in. He wasn't much, he didn't write a lot of zombie stories. As in the case of Reanimator. So, I certainly recommend it if you have any interest in any of those things. And if you're looking to spend some time with Gordon, and you've already seen most of his better known works, give this one a shot.
Yep. All right. Very good. I enjoyed it a lot. I consider it a pleasant surprise. I wasn't really sure how it would be, because when you hear about Stuart Gordon, you don't hear about a lot of his films except his first two as the big ones, and then recently some of the films like Dolls and Stuck and The Pit and the Pendulum and so forth are suddenly become kind of getting revisited, and this was prior to his passing, because they've been getting new releases and whatnot, and I should have expected it to be pretty good, because I saw Stuck and that was pretty good, and that one hadn't been pumped up much either, and all of the films that we're talking about here, Stuck and Dagon and whatnot, are all getting fairly decent reviews on Rotten Tomatoes and all that. So a big surprise, and really enjoyable, both as a Lovecraft adaptation, as a midnight movie, as a good film for October and Halloween run. So, yeah, it's a good film. All right, so any final thoughts on anything related to this movie or Stuart Gordon that we haven't said? Anybody?
Well, one last thing. Stuart Gordon's probably most frequent collaborator is Jeffrey Combs. And I can very much see how Jeffrey Combs, had this film been made 10 years earlier, would have had the lead role.
Absolutely.
And
well,
I think
he kind of looks like him, even.
And I think that would have made Combs is a much better actor. And I think that it really could have elevated this film even more. Maybe that's just my particular Jeffrey Combs bias.
No.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. All right, sounds good. So once again, tribute to Stuart Gordon, who just recently passed at the age of 72, I believe, from multiple organ failure. That's actually a condition. So it probably was that and not a side effect from some other illness. So he'll be missed. As Mike said, he was good to the fans. He loved the fans and whatnot. Mike, did you ever meet him at any convention by any chance?
Stuart Gordon, I think it was at the first Scares of Care, maybe the second. I did get a chance to meet him. Yes.
Right.
And he seemed to me to be a good guy, kind of a quiet guy, kind of a humble guy. He seemed to be good to the fans. I haven't heard anyone ever say anything bad about him. So, you know, I'm happy he made whatever money he did off of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, because God knows he wasn't going to be making it off of most of his genre work.
Sure.
I have a final note, too, Phil. I like how he was wearing a Miskatonic sweatshirt through the whole movie.
Yeah, he sure did. Yeah, which is from most of Lovecraft's stories, University Miskatonic University. Mike, did you get an autograph from him and all that too? Sign pictures or anything like that?
I'm trying to remember if I did or not. It's possible. I'd have to go through my album. It's been a few years now.
Sure, no worries. All right, so folks can check it out. It has a special edition Blu-ray from Vestron, which is, again, is Lionsgate, basically, fully loaded, so you can get that ordered, or you can watch it VOD anywhere, and also it's on Tubi for free with three short spots for commercials. Rest in peace to Stuart Gordon. And with all that stated, Chrissy, why don't you lead us out?
Thank you for tuning into Dark Discussions for this evening's ruminations on Stuart Gordon's Dagon, which is based on the Lovecraft short stories Dagon and
Shadow.
What's the name of the other one? The Shadow over Innsmouth. We hope you're all doing well and come back next week when we will definitely be talking about something else.
Via, 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 via